it's becoming pretty predictable that many or most conversations with lung cancer investigators nowadays quickly focus on the rapidly evolving story of tumor mutations and genomics. And when I met with Dr. Bruce Johnson, he quickly entered this content area, beginning with his overall take on the epidemiology of EGFR mutations.
Amongst adenocarcinomas in people from Western European backgrounds, there's about 15% of patients will have a mutation in the epidermal growth factor receptor. In contrast, in Eastern Asian populations from Japan, Korea, and Eastern China, it runs at about 30 to 40%. Now, in other subsets of patients, those that do not have EGFR mutations can have other mutations. And probably the most important one to detect now is the anaplastic lymphoma kinase rearrangement, or ALK rearrangements. In these patients who have the ALK rearrangements, if they're treated with crizotinib, which is now approved for patients with ALK rearrangements, this subpopulation runs at about 5%. And in these patients who have been previously treated, see response rates in excess of 50% with a progression-free survival of about 10 months. And these patients who have been previously treated have survivals in excess of 2 years. So it looks like it's pretty important to pick these two up.
Another alteration that we heard a lot about this year is ROS1, and we saw some more data on that at ASCO in terms of crizotinib. Can you talk about that story?
Yeah, this was a very interesting story, and it's one that unfolded on the basis of doing laboratory work. And it comes from an original observation that was published in Cell of testing different lung cancers with targeted agents. Then they identified a subset of tumors that crizotinib was active against. And that particular cell line, HCC78, had a ROS1 rearrangement and was sensitive to crizotinib. The Massachusetts General Hospital group and the University of Colorado group set up and began screening for the ROS1 rearrangements on the basis of this, and then began treating those patients. At the time that the abstract was submitted, they'd identified 13 patients with ROS1 rearrangements. And at the time of the presentation, they were able to show that 6 of these 13 had a response to crizotinib, and 12 of the 13 patients have been started on it, continue on treatment. There was only a single patient who progressed at the first look. So it looks like it's quite active against the ROS1 rearrangements. Once again, it runs at about a frequency of 2%. Both the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Brigham and Women's Hospital began screening for the ROS1 rearrangements to begin looking for this and then to allocate the patients to crizotinib. The company that makes crizotinib has opened up their trials for putting patients with ROS1 rearrangements on crizotinib and continuing to assess the response of this agent.
Do you think for practical purposes right now in clinical practice, medical oncologist, for example, has a non-smoker, widespread adenocarcinoma, EGFR, no mutations, no ALK, they should in some way try to get this test done? And how would they do that?
Well, it's a bit of a challenge at the current time. One of the things that obviously one can do is to send them to one of the centers where the test is up and going. I think as this matures, we hope it becomes commercially available. Now, that is the test. One of the things that is evolving and is happening and is going now to the major medical centers is to make a technological innovation to make it simpler to screen for these tests. You know, at the current time, you have to send off your testing to get an EGFR mutation to one place, KRAS to another, and it becomes a challenge for community oncologists to know what test to send for, where it should go, and then to be able to interpret the results. One of the things that is happening at some of the major cancer centers is to develop a next-gen sequencing platform. What that means is that you evolve from the current technology, and one of the things that currently happens, you know, they have multiplex gene testing, meaning it can look for multiple changes in the amino acid sequence. You have, at the current time, with the existing technology, for the rearrangements or amplifications, that is where the chromosomes break and reform, or if you develop multiple copies or amplification of the DNA, you end up having to do what we call as a FISH test. FISH is fluorescence in situ hybridization. It's a labor-intensive test. You end up having to typically count more than 100 nucleoli, and then the criteria for positive are somewhat subjective. So for instance, with the ALK rearrangements, 15% have to have a change in a red dot and a green dot to be called positive. And, you know, there's some that run 13, 14%, which are called negative, and some that run 16, 17%. So it's somewhat arbitrary where you put that cut point. And for each of these tests, at least in our centers, it costs between $500 and $1,000 to have these tests done. One of the things that the next-gen platform will allow us to do is to take a look at multiple chromosomal rearrangements and multiple sources of DNA amplification so that you end up taking a look at hundreds and potentially thousands of genes at the same time on the same platform, somewhere at the cost in the low thousands. And by doing this, the level of effort that it's going to take to try to remember which test you should send where will hopefully become commercially available within the next probably 6 months to 2 years, depending on how this technology rolls out.
Can you talk about what we know about the clinical behavior of tumors based on the type of EGFR mutation present?
Not all EGFR mutations are the same. The two most common that people see are the exon 19 deletion mutations, which are the most common mutation, and those are associated with the highest response rate, which is about 80%, and progression-free survival of somewhere between 15 to 18 months in most centers when you treat them with an epidermal growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor, either gefitinib or erlotinib. The second most common is an L858R mutation, which has response rates of somewhere around 60% and progression-free survival of about 12 months. One of the ones that's sort of dramatically different is something called an insertion mutation of exon 20. And this is one where several amino acids are put into a different part of the epidermal growth factor receptor, and instead of making it sensitive, actually makes it resistant. And so most of us who practice with this every day know that if you get an insertion 20 mutation, that you typically don't treat these patients with erlotinib in first line and probably not in second or third line. Now, one of the things that's going to happen, especially for the mutations, is that we're going to need to know whether the mutation sensitizes it to a specific inhibitor or makes it resistant. And one of the things we think is important for an oncologist who doesn't work with this every day, that you get a prompt and you also are able to send a person to the literature about why this is indeed the case. Probably the leading site for giving these prompts if you don't use it is My Cancer Genome. It's a website that was put together by William Powell, who's the head of hematology oncology at Vanderbilt. And this probably is our leading site for defining both the mutations and whether it's sensitizing or non-sensitizing. So that you aren't concerned I'm putting in a plug, I don't have any financial interest in that particular one. It's an academic site, and I think it has some very unbiased information within it.
I guess the other piece of information would be if there is a trial out there that a patient with your particular alteration might be eligible for. Do you see, you know, better networking of these, you know, phase 1-2 trials tied into mutations?
Well, I think one of the things that is happening is that they're being very directed and focused subgroups of patients referred to phase 1 trials. Probably one of the most dramatic examples of that was an ALK inhibitor. They reported the phase 1 trial results of a new generation of a more potent inhibitor of ALK, or anaplastic lymphoma kinase.
It's a TKI?
Yeah, it's a TKI.
And are they seeing responses?
So in the phase 1 of the patients who they treated who had ALK rearrangements, they ended up treating 6 patients who had an ALK rearrangement who had become resistant to crizotinib, and 4 of those 6 patients had responded. And, you know, that's pretty dramatic for almost any resistant population to be able to treat effectively in acquired resistance.
Were they able to identify any new mutations or biologic explanation in terms of what was going on?
Well, within that presentation, they haven't, but you know, there's been both a publication by Alice Shaw in Science and Translational Medicine defining a panoply of resistance mechanisms in patients who are ALK positive with rearrangements. And at the ASCO meeting, Dr. Doble from the University of Colorado presented their mechanisms of resistance. It's in contrast to the acquired resistance to the epidermal growth factor receptors, gefitinib or erlotinib, in EGFR mutant patients where there's one predominant mechanism, the gatekeeper mutation is acquired, which is the T790M. a threonine to methionine amino acid change at position 790 is present in the majority of patients with acquired resistance. In crizotinib resistant, it's a much more diverse group of mutations. You both get a gatekeeper mutation, but it certainly isn't present in the majority of patients, and you get a number of different bypass mechanisms that cause resistance.
In terms of practical issues about testing right now, which patients do you think, let's talk about general oncologists and community-based practice, should have EGFR and ALK testing? All patients with non-squamous? Do you factor in smoking?
So we've tested patients with non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer. So for us, that includes large cell neuroendocrine, it includes adenocarcinoma, and includes non-small cell, not otherwise specified. We haven't been routinely testing squamous cell carcinomas, and I'll come back to that in a moment. We don't use the smoking parameter because the patients who smoke who have EGFR mutations or ALK rearrangements have similar outcomes as patients who don't smoke. And it's just a numbers phenomena, meaning that we end up testing people, and although it's less common, those patients' outcomes are meaningfully impacted. And our threshold for employing a test as a predictive marker is that we like to see it present at least a 2% frequency. And indeed, EGFR mutations are present at more than 2% in people who smoke or who have recently quit. So we don't use the smoking parameter. Now, the thing that's a little bit more complicated, if you have a limited amount of money for the testing, you obviously can increase your chances of finding a meaningful mutation by selecting patients who haven't smoked very much, which is either a person who's never smoked or a person who's smoked 30 pack years or less or quit more than 15 years ago. Thus far, we don't test squamous cell carcinomas. Now, one of the things that's happened is that there'll be a publication coming out in Nature sometime in the next month or two on the genomic characterization of squamous cell carcinomas. And you can find potential targets in about half where there are existing drugs for those targets. And so those clinical trials will begin starting in squamous cell carcinomas sometime this fall to early next year. And we don't know yet whether those are going to make the criteria that I mentioned, where you see response rates in excess of 50% in some of these specific targets, and whether you're going to have these long progression-free survivals. So for example, the family of fibroblast growth factor receptors are abnormal in about 20% of squamous cell carcinomas, and there's drugs directed against these FGFR targets. And so that is a very large proportion of squamous cell carcinomas, so you'll see those trials that are going to be beginning this fall or have already started.
You know, it's funny, as you were talking about, you know, the number that you'd have to justify testing before you said 2%, in my own mind, I flashed 1 in 1,000, but I guess it's all in judgment. I mean, I was thinking, well, you know, you've got a pretty non-toxic therapy. I mean, am I correct in saying there have been patients with squamous cell who've been found to have EGFR mutations?
Yeah, there's few, but most of the time they're patients who have not smoked and they're from unusual subsets. It's pretty rare for patients to have EGFR mutations.
As long as we're talking, kind of branching out, what about small cell carcinoma? What do we know about mutations there?
Well, it's a little disappointing. And actually, the first clinical research I ever did was in small cell lung carcinoma and taking a look at long-term survivors in that subgroup. And one of the things that is so far limiting is the availability of tumor specimens. You know, one of the reasons why we've been able to learn so much about adenocarcinomas of the lung and squamous cell carcinomas of the lung, which is now just coming out, is because there's a large population of resected tumors. And by and large, from what we know from the Cancer Genome Atlas, where we mostly genotyped patients who had advanced disease, is that the early stage resected disease rather accurately reflects the genomic changes that we see in patients with advanced disease. And because we had these groups of tumors that are relatively large, because they typically need, you know, between a half a gram of tissue to undergo these complex genomic characterizations that then lead to the ability to be able to target them. With small cell lung carcinoma, only about 2% of those patients are ever resected. And one of the things that we believe is that it's sort of unlikely that this reflects the biology of the typical patients that presents with disease spread to the lymph nodes, which is limited stage disease, which is about a third of the small cell patients, or those that have extensive stage disease. And it's going to probably require not just an effort to sequence, but you're also going to have a prospective effort to collect adequate amounts of tumor from metastatic sites to be able to do the characterization that's led to the increased understanding of both adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. And there's international groups now of people who are trying to put together a program to get adequate amounts of tumor tissue to begin this characterization. The second thing that's happened is that the ability to genomically characterize the tumor specimens has also undergone somewhat of a revolution in that the typical amount that they started out in what's called the Cancer Genome Atlas, the program to characterize these, has moved from having the relatively large amounts of tumor of 200 milligrams to a half a gram to be able to work with relatively small biopsy specimens and accurately genomically characterize it. So we'll probably have to work prospectively to collect adequate amounts of tissue, but we'll probably be able to work with quite a bit less.
So I want to ask you about a couple of things that happened at ASCO, but just a couple other follow-up questions. HER2 and lung cancer.
Well, first of all, you know, HER2 is activated in breast cancer amplified in about 20 to 25%. It's amplified in adenocarcinomas of the lung in about 2 or 3% to the levels that we see in breast cancer. So it's relatively rare for it to be activated by amplification similar to what we see in breast cancer. For patients who have activation of HER2 in lung cancer, some of them have mutations, and it's an insertion mutation, and it's pretty similar to what we see in the insertion mutations of the epidermal growth factor receptor. There's several amino acids in the same part of the molecule as is present in the HER2 mutants. And these aren't sensitive to EGFR inhibitors. The sort of most promising activity that we've seen against HER2 mutants has been with a combination of neratinib, which is a inhibitor that's against HER2 and EGFR, and an agent, temsirolimus, which is an agent that's approved in renal cell carcinoma. It's a mTOR inhibitor. And that's been looked at both preclinically, and there's some data from phase 1 trials showing that it's been active in the majority of patients with HER2 mutants. Unfortunately, those two drugs, which were owned by Pfizer, were competitive with an existing program when they purchased Wyeth. Wyeth was the original manufacturer of neratinib and temsirolimus. And dacomitinib, which is another pan-EGFR HER family inhibitor, was competitive with this, so they ended up licensing neratinib to another company. And we're in the process of negotiating to try to bring that trial back for the HER2 mutants. And once again, that's another 2% of lung cancer.
You mentioned BRAF. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what we know about that in lung cancer, but also the concept of, are we moving towards a situation where you're going to find a mutation, use the agent regardless of what kind of tumor, and i.e., you know, agents like vemurafenib?
So BRAF mutations are present in about half or more of melanomas, and as has been published in the past year, vemurafenib, which is a BRAF inhibitor, is quite active in melanoma, and it's approved now for melanoma with BRAF mutants. And as I mentioned before, you know, it looks like there's a response rate in excess of 50% and 8 to 10 months of progression-free survival. So it meets those criteria that we've talked about before of showing rather dramatic activity, particularly in a disease that's not been terribly responsive. Now, it turns out there's BRAF mutants that are present in lung cancer. The majority of BRAF mutants in melanoma are at one specific amino acid, and they typically cause a V600E mutation at position 600. It turns out the BRAF mutants in lung cancer are present in 2%, and a less proportion of them are V600E mutations, which is where vemurafenib and some of the other BRAF inhibitors are active. We currently have a trial in patients with BRAF mutations, and we've treated 7 patients with BRAF mutations, and of those, there's only been a single patient who was unable to take the therapy because they developed an allergic reaction. And so it looks like we're seeing responses in BRAF mutants. Now, in contrast, in colon cancer, it looks like the BRAF inhibitors are not terribly active. So it looks like, although we see similar findings in lung that have been seen in melanoma, It's not true thus far for colon cancer, and so it looks like it does make a difference. Now, the other point that you raised is, you know, should we be just testing this and treating all the tumors the same? AstraZeneca has taken that approach and reported it with AZD6244, which is a MEK inhibitor where they've been treating patients with BRAF mutant disease to attempt to control it. So people have taken that approach as treating it by the mutation.
Finally, I want to ask you, before we get again back to ASCO, about KRAS. You called it Kirsten-RAS. I'm not sure I've heard that one before.
Yeah, that's actually where the K comes from. And it comes from the name of the scientist who initially discovered it in rat tumors.
Interesting.
So you used to be able to name these things after yourself. So
anyhow, it certainly is not an uncommon mutation, not just in lung cancer. What do we know about agents that might be active in this situation?
Well, one of the things that we were very encouraged about in lung cancer was a presentation made by one of my colleagues, Passiani, in the oral non-small cell lung cancer session, where they took patients with second-line therapy in non-small cell lung carcinoma with KRAS mutations and treated half of them with docetaxel and the other half with docetaxel plus selumetinib, which is AZD6244. And in that group, they took a look at response rates and progression-free survival and overall survival, and they saw a rather dramatic benefit. There were no responses in the KRAS mutants who did not get selumetinib, and they ended up seeing 37% response rates in a randomized phase 2 trial. The progression-free survival was also longer. The overall survival had a median of about 9 months for the patients treated with docetaxel plus selumetinib, and it was about 5 months for the patients treated with docetaxel alone. The hazard ratio for the survival was about 0.8, which is a little bit disappointing because they crossed over at the end, but certainly the response rates and the progression-free survival were very encouraging, and the company is now having discussions about moving on to a potential randomized phase 3 strategy. And this was a randomized phase 2 trial of approximately 80 patients, 40-some in each arm.
That's fascinating. Have there been any other agents where there's been encouraging data like this with KRAS-positive tumors?
The other major ongoing clinical effort in KRAS mutants comes from preclinical data of combining MEK inhibitors plus PI3 kinase inhibitors. KRAS activates both those pathways, and they have been working toward inhibiting both pathways and have been seeing encouraging responses. I didn't see any of the presentations on these combinations specifically on lung cancer at this presentation, and they weren't in either of the sessions, so I can't comment specifically on it. Most of these trials are still in phase 1 and the dose escalation.
Any other novel agents in lung cancer that you're excited about? I ask you about ARC-197, I think it's called Devatinib, Metmab, any of the other novel agents that you are excited about?
Well, let me point out the one that I'm sort of more enthusiastic, and I'll come back to those in a minute. I think one of the ones that we've had personal experience with, as well as what was reported at ASCO, is anti-PD-1, which is an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And they've seen rather dramatic anti-tumor activity in it in melanoma, which is where it's been initially developed, where we've seen activity of another immune inhibitor, ipilimumab, that had been published in the past year. So anti-PD-1 is one of the immune checkpoint inhibitors. It's a monoclonal antibody. And they reported the results at this ASCO of about 70 patients with non-small cell lung carcinoma. And they've reported it at three different dose levels, 1, 3, and 10 milligrams per kilogram. At 3 and 10 milligrams per kilogram, they've seen responses in approximately 20%. And some of them are very encouraging in that they can go on for years. They've seen a disproportionate share of responses in squamous cell carcinomas and are considering further trials taking a look at this compared to chemotherapy. So, you know, and we have our own personal experience where we've seen rather dramatic and prolonged responses in subsets of these patients. Thus far, we don't have a predictive biomarker in identifying who it is. But as I said before, the response rate overall in the lung cancer population, once you get at 3 or 10 milligrams, looks like it's somewhere around 20%, which would be as high or higher than the conventional agents of 10% of pemetrexed and docetaxel of second-line lung cancer.
Another target we're hearing a lot about is MET. Any comments on MetMab?
It's a monoclonal antibody, and it's a single, you know, typically antibodies have two arms. It's a single-arm antibody directed against MET and prevents the ligand hepatocyte growth factor from binding to the MET receptor. The randomized phase 2 trial that's taken place tested giving erlotinib with or without MET, and they had developed a diagnostic tool taking a look for MET, and they prospectively found that about half patients with non-small cell lung cancer they called positive by using immunohistochemical criteria of 0 to 3 plus. Those with 2 or 3 plus MET treated with erlotinib plus MET-MAB had a longer progression-free survival and survival than the patients who got erlotinib alone. Now, one of the reasons why the MET immunohistochemical biomarker is particularly important is because those patients who had low MET, who had 0 or 1 plus, who got erlotinib plus MET-MAB actually did worse than the patients who got erlotinib alone. So the randomized phase 3 trial that's currently ongoing to validate the stuff seen in the prospective randomized phase 2 trial that's been reported at ASCO and is in the midst of undergoing review for publication is currently only enrolling patients with 2 or 3 plus MET. You have to be tested before you go on the trial so that only patients with 2 or 3 plus MET are eligible for it.
What about ARC-197?
So ARCUL-197 is another MET inhibitor. Once again, it's being tested with erlotinib. And once again, they've seen some interesting activity in KRAS mutants where they've looked at it.
Any comments on the so-called SELECT trial reported at ASCO?
The SELECT trial was a phase 2 trial where patients were given adjuvant erlotinib. And these patients, as I said before, were ones that were prospectively identified as having EGFR mutations, and the patients were given whatever was deemed to be the appropriate approved adjuvant therapy. So for instance, if it was a stage 2 patient, they commonly got 4 cycles of chemotherapy, and once that finished, they were given up to 2 years of erlotinib as an adjuvant therapy. I think one of the things that was very interesting in that trial, of the 30 patients who were out 2 years, only one or two of those patients had recurred within those 2 years.
I guess we should mention that everybody got treated.
That's correct.
Single-arm trial.
It's a single-arm trial. And as I remember it, only a single patient or perhaps 2 patients out of those 30 recurred while they got treated with erlotinib. But right as the treatment ended, you began seeing the relapses. So in looking at this, I think it's interesting. And certainly now within the cooperative groups, there's a proposal to begin studying giving adjuvant erlotinib in the EGFR mutant population.
What are your feelings about using either an EGFR TKI or crizotinib in the appropriate patient, in an educated patient in the adjuvant setting, you know, not small risk of recurrence, comes to you and says, will you write the prescription?
Well, so far I haven't personally had to face this because we've had a trial for it. I think one of the things that I have been doing is that in a setting where there's known to be benefit of adjuvant chemotherapy, I've given that. So for instance, if a person comes in and they have a stage 2, let's say for instance they have a lesion that's about 4 centimeters and they have a hilar lymph node involved, a stage 2 patient where adjuvant chemotherapy is clearly of benefit, we treat those patients still with 4 cycles of adjuvant treatment. The decision about whether one should give adjuvant therapy or not, I have a discussion with the patient. Of those patients who I think are particularly high risk, so for instance, patients who start out with stage 3 disease, or if they have 2 different tumors that are both EGFR mutant, I'll have a discussion with them about treating them. So for instance, one of the things that happened is that I saw a patient who'd had 2 lung cancers resected, separated by 3 years, and both had a similar EGFR mutation. And that particular person, luckily I had the SELECT trial available to me because of the center here, and he actually came up from another city on the Eastern Seaboard to come up and get on the adjuvant trial because he specifically sought it out because of his concerns about his risks of recurrence.
How did you find trying to get people through 2 years of adjuvant erlotinib? This was discussed in the presentation, and as to be expected, it wasn't necessarily that easy, I gather.
Yeah, as in the presentation, a substantial proportion of the patients ended up having to be dose reduced or have it stopped. Of the patients who I have treated with long-term EGFR TKI, we've ended up having to commonly cut the dose. One of the things that is obviously the case is that erlotinib, the agent that we use, is given very close to the maximum tolerated dose. And when a person has to take it long-term, it can be quite a challenge. The part that makes us not too terribly concerned is things that we learned since the design of the trial. One is that the levels where it takes to inhibit the growth or actually kill the cells are probably about 1/10 to 1/100 or what are present in the plasma, so that, you know, cutting the dose by either half or 2/3 probably doesn't make a big difference about the anti-tumor effect. The second thing is that if you can't give it for 2 years, meaning if you give it for a shorter period of time, you actually have to stop the drug, we aren't terribly concerned in that the time for emergence of resistance on average with erlotinib is about 1 year, you know, when we begin seeing acquired resistance. And so if you get at least 1 year in, we think that probably is a very good length of time. So if you end up having to stop it early, you know, if I was going to design a trial, I don't know that I would attempt to give it for 2 years. I think probably a more reasonable length of time would be 1 year.
One other question, and then I want to just close out by asking you about lung cancer screening, but any comments on the issue of afatinib and particularly cetuximab afatinib in patients who've previously received an EGFR TKI?
Well, afatinib, one of the things that's been rather disappointing in general is the trials for patients with acquired resistance. So, you know, one of the things that they've tried is a series of irreversible inhibitors for patients who'd get a previous EGFR TKI and are treated, and the response rates, the highest that we've seen is 7%, and most of the trials have been hovering at around 2 or 3%. You know, the one trial that you mentioned here that's been most promising has been one that's been done by Vanderbilt Memorial Sloan Kettering in Colorado, and that is giving the irreversible inhibitor afatinib with cetuximab, where they've seen response rates in excess of 50%. And was based mostly on preclinical work done by William Powell. And the thing there, they believe, is that they are able to inhibit not only the tyrosine kinase domain of the receptor, but also to block the binding of the agonist. The original hypothesis is that this would work in patients with T790M, which is the most common form of resistance, but they've actually seen anti-tumor activity in patients who both have this acquired resistance as well as the others. And so it's by far the most promising combination that we've seen in acquired resistance. And it's one of the ones that, you know, we as an institution are trying to get involved with for our patients as well.
What's your take on afatinib? There was some data presented at ASCO. It didn't directly compare to chemo as opposed to the other TKIs, but do you have any sense sort of upfront how afatinib might compare to erlotinib or gefitinib?
Well, the one you mentioned is a trial where they compared afatinib given as a single agent against chemotherapy of pemetrexed and cisplatin. And they saw similar outcomes to what we've seen in the other trials of giving either gefitinib or erlotinib versus chemotherapy. There's been 5 or 6 trials presented around the world with that general trial design. The part that I was sort of happy to see similar effects, but one of the things that we had hoped with the class of irreversible inhibitors where we'd seen a bit of activity in acquired resistance is we'd see something that looked a bit different. And the data that was presented showed the typical progression-free survival of about 10 months. And certainly the toxicities of the irreversible inhibitors look a bit more, so it's not clear what role this is going to have relative to the existing TKIs. One of the things that will be an interesting strategy for potential approval is it's one of the few trials that's been done here in the United States, I'll say actually the only trial, specific for mutants where they compared a tyrosine kinase inhibitor to chemotherapy and showed similar outcomes as the others. And so it'll be interesting to find out if this drug would be the one that is approved for ones with EGFR mutants.